Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Marigold Clothing, making fashion fun since 1989, in Broad Ripple, featuring women's clothing, gifts, and accessories, and committed to customer service. More on Facebook or at marigoldclothing.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we head out of town to talk with Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms near Greenfield, who aims to raise food this year to help supply food banks with fresh produce. We'll also talk with home canning expert Suzanne Krowiak about the current Communities Can exhibit at the Indiana Historical Society, and about an upcoming free event where you can learn about growing and canning your own food. And we'll talk to Jordan Gleason and Holly Miller of Blackacre Brewing in Indianapolis about a Facebook post that went viral and the reaction in the hospitality community. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Things that I like so much about this week's show is that it shows the power that individual people have to make a difference. And we're not talking about a small difference here. We're talking about people who are tackling big issues, social justice issues. And I love that people in the broader food community are taking on these issues and not shying away from a big problem. For example, the issue of hunger and food insecurity is one that hits the local food community hard, and there is so much desire there to help alleviate the problem. That's why what Greenfield farmer Jonathan Lawler is doing is so inspiring. You'll hear from him today about his efforts to help feed the hungry here in central Indiana by growing fresh produce for food banks. But we'll also hear about how one person's reaction to an injustice in the workplace has led to a greater awareness of the harassment of women in the hospitality industry. Jordan Gleason and Holly Miller of Blackacre Brewing have shined a spotlight on the issue and have made a stand about what is no longer acceptable behavior. And it's great this week to be able to highlight all of these efforts. When Greenfield Transportation Company owner Jonathan Lawler realized that the problem of hunger and food insecurity was an issue in his Hancock County community, he set out to do something about it. The former produce farmer and his family decided that they would devote some of their 36-acre farm to raising fresh vegetables for local food banks. He plans to have 12 acres of his own farm in production this year, as well as 20 acres in Pendleton and another 6 in Fortville, with a goal of raising 500,000 pounds of produce for local food banks. I stopped by Jonathan's Hancock County farm recently to hear about how the idea came about and how he plans to accomplish the goal.
My son said that there was kids taking food home from the food pantry, and if you leave my farm and drive there, it's nothing but farms.
All around us.
All around us. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I thought, well, maybe I can make a difference. And I talked to the soup kitchen here, and they told me that they couldn't get produce, or that it was very difficult to get. And then talked to Gleaners Food Bank, Midwest Food Bank. Produce was their number one thing they could not get. Then I started talking to the township trustees about teenagers coming in and asking for food. And they would love to be able to give them good stuff, but they're giving them box food and canned food. And I decided we were going to just like plant like a couple acres, but we decided to just turn the whole farm into feeding people with local food.
Now, how can you do that? I mean, the farm, I'm sure, is you know, part of your job. You know, this is you. I mean, you support your own family.
Well, I mean, I've been able to finance it off of my transportation I have a transportation marketing firm. I had, when I first started getting into it, I had a couple of gentlemen approach me and talk to me about starting a nonprofit that just wasn't for donating food, but to also bring people out to the farm and teach them how to grow their own food. We just actually just had a new guy join our board, and he, his name's Gabe Nix. He is our military outreach, to bring military vets in to teach them how to farm. And not only that, we plan on standing them up on their own acreage next year. So that's...
So you have a not-for-profit set up already?
Yeah, it's in the process. I tell you what, I don't think I've ever done anything as hard as a not-for-profit. I mean, it just amazes me how much of a business it truly is. And that's not what we're about. We're about feeding people. We've had, you know, Richard Petty actually reached out to us, and he's putting on a fundraiser for us in July. Ruth Chris Steakhouse is putting on a fundraiser for us this fall, and we're doing a farm-to-table dinner and auction. So, you know, that, and we're also going to start looking really hard at ag grants, because, you know, a lot of those dollars can go other places. Not only that, we will sell a small percentage of the produce, and that's already going to a couple local restaurants.
Well, now, I'm sure people wonder, you know, what's the catch? You know, what's in it for you? Why are you doing it?
What's in it for me? Well, yeah, I had a professor from Ohio State University, like, call me out on Facebook and said that I'm probably swimming in donation dollars right now. He is more than welcome to come here and see that we really aren't. I have made the least amount of money I've ever made in my life doing this. And the last, you know, from the day I decided to do it, all the research, everything, I've had more joy than I've ever had in my life as well. So, you know, there's no, I mean, maybe that's the catch. I just want to feel good about myself. I don't know.
Now, when did it start? When did you make that decision to do this?
It was in the fall when my son told me about that, you know, and me and my wife talked, and we were just, like I said, we were looking at just going to plant a couple acres, maybe 2 or 3 acres, and we just started researching all the hunger. And, you know, when Jill told me, well, you know, if you bring in too much, you know, we want other places to go. So I thought, well, maybe I'll talk to gleaners. And I talked to a gentleman there that was volunteering there, and he was like, how much do you think you could raise if you, you know, really tried? And I thought about that, and I kept hearing that 135,000 people were food insecure. And I thought, well, that's when I told my wife, and that was like in November. I said, let's just make the whole farm grow for the hungry. You know, I think we can finance it. And I've talked to a couple guys who said that we should maybe go that direction. They can help with a nonprofit. And that's when we went for it.
So the idea for raising fresh produce to help feed the hungry and the food insecure, how did that idea progress?
Well, it was just, without getting too political, it makes me mad that Indiana could feed the United States 3 times over. But what do we grow in fields now? Ethanol, soy diesel, boxes of macaroni and cheese. Not only that, I mean, I decided, you know, I'm tired of having to put on the front, even though I live in a county where, you know, it's very conventional. And, you know, I decided that, you know, I'm going to show the environmental aspect of taking care of the land. The, you know, the ability that we do have the ability to feed our own, our community. I'm so sick and tired of hearing American farmers have to feed the world. That drives me nuts. You know, we're trying to feed the world, and we have people, 135,000 people in Indianapolis that are food insecure. You know, that just does not make any sense to me. You know, and I don't have all the answers. On the produce side, I think I do.
So you have some answers to the problem of getting fresh produce to people who want it.
The state of Indiana used to be a produce powerhouse. And unfortunately, now it's everything's commodity farming. And that's not the farmer's fault by any stretch. I mean, they're under the same broken food system that we all are. You know, they're doing what they need to do to make a living, and they're some of the hardest working guys I know, and gals, you know. So it's not about that. It's about us being able to give people, you know, real food, you know. I used to be one of those people that I believe that someone who was hungry lived in a bridge under Indianapolis. There was no hunger in my county. And, you know, I found out that I'm wrong. I would see kids who were overweight at a soup kitchen or at Gleaners and go, what is he doing there? He doesn't need that food. And again, after speaking to doctors, I was very wrong, you know, and I won't make those mistakes again. Food deserts aren't just in cities. They're out here, too.
That's a very interesting point, and I don't think that's one that people think about very often.
Right. If you take somebody that lives in one of these small towns, they don't have transportation, their food choices are Dollar General or gas station. And I don't know if you've seen the produce in Dollar General. It's junk, and it's expensive. And that's just not something that works for us. We need to make sure that those people have access to produce, just like the people in the city have access to it. My hope in all this is that more farmers get involved. And, you know, it's time that we step up. I think it's great what people do with the community gardens and stuff. It's time we step up, start using our tractors, our innovation, our machinery, to start, you know, stop planting. I mean, not that I'm saying to stop planting commodity corn, but we can plant just as much sweet corn to feed people. We can plant green beans just like we do soybeans, you know. I mean, we can plant real food that you can walk into the fields and eat. That's what we need to do, and it's just not happening.
We've been talking with Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms near Greenfield. We'll be back with more from Jonathan here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Greenfield farmer and transportation company owner Jonathan Lawler has an ambitious plan to help fight hunger. He plans to raise 500,000 pounds of fresh produce this year for Central Indiana food banks. I talked with Jonathan on his Hancock County farm this week about how he plans to accomplish that goal and what the local, national, and international reaction has been to his plan.
Here we have 12 acres that we're putting into production. Those will be intensively farmed. Our goal is to try to get 20,000 pounds off of each acre.
Is that doable?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Tyler Goff with Indy Urban Acres, he does an amazing job. I think he puts 2 full acres into production. He actually is a savior. I've talked to the people that get his food. You know, they are extremely grateful for it. And, you know, what we're doing, we're going to try to do the same thing out here. Then we're actually field cropping green beans and sweet corn. We're going to do about 15 acres of sweet corn and 6 acres of green beans. So here it'll only be tender crops. You know, it'll be your tomatoes, cucumbers, zucchini. And we're going to be back planting. And, you know, it's going to be difficult, but we're going to do it. We've had close to 750 people sign up to volunteer. So
you do have an event coming up, right?
Yeah, planting day, our opening day. I just look out at my fields and think I have so much work to do. But, that'll be great. They can come out. They can see the animals that we have. They can, you know, see how we actually plant, how we're using plasticulture to plant. They'll see how we use drip irrigation to make it very sustainable, cut down on water usage.
So people can come out and get their hands dirty.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what we want.
What has been the reaction in Indiana and beyond?
We've had a lot of, we had Richard Petty reached out to us. They're doing a fundraiser for us. I've stopped taking friend requests on Facebook.
Did you reach your limit?
No, it's just weird. I mean, number one, I'd get messages that I couldn't read because they were in different languages. And
you've been getting messages from around the world?
South America, Australia, China, Denmark, a lot of messages from Denmark, a bunch of people from Scotland. There's one lady from Scotland that I can't post anything on Facebook without her commenting on it. So
are these good comments?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've gotten some bad comments, but you know, most of them are good comments. You know, I mean, a lot of people, I think, you know, they think I'm doing something that has never been done before, but the truth is there's other farms that do this. I mean, I don't know if it's because we're in Indiana or that I was a not-for-profit or I just one day decided, you know, people think the thunderbolt hit me, but, you know, it's been mostly, we've gotten good comments. I've made connections with, a lot of people, you know, Roseanne Barr, I think that's her name. She's liked a bunch of my tweets lately, which is kind of weird, but,
So now you've said you've gotten some national media requests for interviews too.
Yeah, yeah. CBS is coming here to do a story. You know, once we're in full production, RFD-TV, which is the rural farm network, they're going to do a half an hour show and actually follow the production here to gleaners to the end user or Midwest Food. I'm not sure who they're going to use, but they're going to kind of see what we do on a daily basis and then actually see how Gleaners helps distribute that. So I think that'll be a pretty cool thing. So
what's that been like to get the national press for this idea that just hit you just recently?
I don't know. It's been kind of weird. I mean, I've gotten phone calls from people too. The only phone call that I got that really was Richard Petty's people. I was like, oh, that's cool. I'm an avid NASCAR fan. But I've had a lot of people say that they ask me, are you sure you're organic? We see your picture. You don't look like the organic, typical organic guy.
Now, that's an interesting comment.
I've gotten a lot of that, actually.
Have you really?
Yeah, you know. Or how can you have an organic farm if you have tractors? And I'm just like, I don't really know how to answer that. I couldn't imagine doing it without equipment.
So you are growing organically?
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, I haven't figured out a way to grow green beans and sweet corn without synthetic pesticides. As soon as somebody comes up with something, I will switch over to it. I have no problem with that. I grew synthetically. I grew conventionally for a long time. I worked on my father-in-law's 6,000-acre farm.
So you come from a very conventional farming background.
Yeah, the farming background that I have, I mean, my grandfather was a produce farmer in Franklin, Indiana. And I think he lived by chemicals, you know, he loved them. And then my father-in-law, I mean, seeing his generation of farmer just saying there's something not right with how we're doing things, you know, I was trying to figure out how to do no-till for vegetable gardening, and he was like, don't do no-till. I know they say no-till's better. It's not. It's bad. You know,
that was the conventional wisdom.
That's what that's his idea, is that no-till is bad, but every conventional farmer switched to no-till, and he's like, look at what our soil looks like now. He goes, look at how much flooding you see, and it's because we're not turning the ground over. We're not allowing it to be able to suck up the nutrients. We're not exposing the micronutrients to oxygen. So I told, and I've had guys stop here and say, you're not supposed to till, or you're tilling too deep. And, you know, talking to guys like in Georgia, those produce farmers down there, they'll till just as deep as their tractors will allow them. And there, you do a soil test on their soil versus the conventional no-till guys. Their soil is gorgeous and alive, and you know, they have to keep adding inputs to the conventional stuff. So yeah, we're trying to do more than just feed people. We're trying to educate people and say that, you know, there's a better way, a more environmentally sound way to raise our food. I want to see these market gardeners and these people like that continue to go to the farmers market and interact with people so people can connect with their food. But I'd also like to see some growers step up and plant to scale.
You know, do it in a big way.
Yeah, really scale up their operation, scale like they do down in Florida. I mean, I spent all winter, you know, I networked with some farmers down in Florida, and man, those guys, that's what I see missing here, you know. Number one, their produce production is unbelievable, and I talk to them, and people will automatically assume, like South Florida, well, they can grow year-round. They can't. They can't grow in the summertime. It's too hot. There's too many bugs. It's not economical for them to do it. Their growing season is a month and a half longer than ours. But they grow in the wintertime versus we grow in the summer. So talking to these guys and seeing how I was at this farm and it was 6 acres maybe. This guy supplied 2 grocery stores and like 5 restaurants. And then he had a store there on his farm. I think me and my wife paid $20 and we had 2 big things of tomatoes and stuff. And when I was there, a chef from a local restaurant was there looking at the plants that he had asked this guy to plant just for him. And he was just looking at him and he was getting what he needed for the day. And I was just like, wow, we need this back in Indiana big time, you know, and, hopefully, you know, people like me and others can start trending that way. You know, we would love to see that, get people really connected with their food again. I've had a lot of older folks say, you know, we did it like this. That's how we did it, you know, and, you know, if we can just connect with the right people, that'll happen.
We've been talking with Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms in Greenfield. You can volunteer at the farm on planting day, May 7th. Look for information about the event and the farm on Facebook or go to brandywinecreekfarms.org. Home canning expert and master food preserver Suzanne Krowiak took on an interesting challenge recently. She canned the food that's on display at a current exhibit at the Indiana Historical Society. The Communities Can exhibit brings to life a community canning facility that was in operation in Muncie in 1948. Suzanne tells us about her involvement in the exhibit and also about a free event called Planning to Canning that takes place April 30th at Indy Urban Acres in Indianapolis.
It's one of the You Are There exhibits at the Indiana Historical Society. And so for people who haven't been, they do them on a number of topics and time periods. And this one is called Communities Can. And it's a 1948 community canning center that actually existed in Muncie. The Ball Company did it.
So they recreated that.
They recreated this industrial setting. It was a big factory, but there in the main room, it was mostly women who would bring in the produce that they had grown in their gardens. And then they would work together in groups to slice the peel and chop the apples and put everything in jars. And then all of the jars would go kind of behind the scenes in this factory and would be canned on site by the Ball Company. And then people would leave with their jars. So
just... So that was really happening back in the late 40s.
That was really happening in 1948. And so it was really a wonderful resource for the community. I would love something like that to happen now. I mean, with all the farmers markets, with people doing their own gardens, it was a way to divide up the labor. It was a way to pool resources. So it was the Ball Company supporting the community in this way, providing this, the equipment, the tools, the space. And so they would gather in groups around these tables, you know, do their chopping, whatever they needed to do, cooking the jam, whatever. They'd put it in the jars. The jars would disappear behind the scenes in the factory. They would be canned, and people would come pick them up the next day and take them home.
Well, I think that sounds like a very cool way to do it.
Right.
I mean, how neat. And so So the Historical Society has recreated that.
They have recreated the room where the women worked to prepare the fruits and vegetables and the jars. And so you walk into the exhibit. There are a number of actors, three or four actors. And these are people who... So when the Historical Society does these exhibits, they take a photograph. And they then bring that photograph to life. So the photograph from the canning center, they look at, okay, they see these women around the table. They're like, who are these women? Do we know? How do we find out who they are? They do it there in their forensic librarian CSI museum edition. They find out who they are. And there's a little boy in the side of the picture, I remember. And they discuss and figure out who's the boy. Is he still alive? Where did he live? So the women in the exhibit, the actresses in the exhibit, are based on real people. They know where they lived. They know, you know, what their family situation was. So they're talking about events of their lives that were happening at the time. So you get to talk to them. You get to learn a little bit about what it was like to, you know, grow your own fruits and vegetables in this post-war period. And then you walk into the rest of the exhibit, which is modern day. So it's not modern day in the sense, there aren't any actors in there, but it's an educational wall. It's a history of food preservation. It's a little bit about the different types of food preservation you can do. Freezing, dehydrating, canning, fermenting. So it's really a really so well done. And it was just an honor to be asked to be a part of it and to see it from that side of things.
Now, tell me how you did get to become a part of it.
Well, because they're forensic people. They found me. Like, literally, they found me, I think, through the food swap online, and they knew that I taught canning classes and that I was a master preserver. So it started with just wanting my input and my advice on, are they doing this right? Are they, how do we get the technical part of this right? And so it was, they were doing what they do, which is looking for feedback from people who know about the topics they're recreating. And so then I was on their community advisory committee. And so there were a number of people on, you know, urban farmers, other community organizations having to do with the local food system. And then when it came time to actually design the exhibit, they knew they wanted this wall of jars. And so they asked me if I would can it. And in a moment of insanity, I said yes.
No. So a wall of jars full of canned product.
Right, full of home canned goods. And I mean, I was so, I'm joking, because I was so happy to do it. And it really felt like an art project, because it wasn't just, okay, we need to fill these shelves with jars. It needed to look interesting. It needed to be a part of this, you know, so you don't just have the historians a part of this. You have the visual artists that are a part of designing the exhibit. So it was thinking about what products are going to look good together, what's going to look good inside the jar. You know, for this kind of thing where you're on glass shelves, backlit, you know, cranberry sauce may not be the most attractive thing. So, you know, thinking about what pickled red onions or peach or carrots, brightly colored things, I thought a lot about how they would actually look in the jar. And so whole pieces of fruits or vegetables were going to be the most aesthetically appealing. And then how's it all going to work together? How are the colors going to blend? How are they going to go from one to the other? So it did feel, it was really fun. It felt like a big art project.
How did the exhibit grow? I mean, it's become a thing, you know, and it's spawned some other events, right?
Right. So they really want to. The Historical Society really is committed to community programming, and everything they have there is for people to learn how to do things or just learn the history, learn more about their community, and so. As part of the community programming for Communities Can exhibit, they want to do a series of educational community events having to do mostly like planning and canning is what they're calling them. So how do you plan if you want to have your own garden? How do you go about that? People who've never done it before can feel very intimidated. So they want to provide resources on how do you go about this if you've never done it before. So on April 30th, we're having the first planning to canning event, and it's going to be at Indy Urban Acres, which is an urban farm, part of the Parks Department, and it's an 8-acre farm, and everything they produce is donated to local food banks. So it's a really wonderful space, wonderful farm, wonderful organization. And so at the planning to canning event, Tyler, who's the farm manager there, will give a tour of the farm and then a really gardening 101. How do you get started? What grows well together? What are some of the misconceptions about starting your own home garden? What needs to be seeded? What can you use starter plants for? So just really everything to give people the confidence to try it on their own. And so then after the gardening part of the programming, then I will do a canning demonstration and show people how to safely can at home the things that they grow in their own garden, which is easier than people think, but it can be very intimidating. So oftentimes at these events, people just need to watch someone else do it, see everyone live to tell the tale, and they go home and excited to can their own produce. And it's the perfect time of year. The outdoor farmers markets are going to start. We're going to start seeing more and more local produce. So even if people don't have their own space for an outdoor garden, they can take advantage of the farmers markets and buy produce there and go home and can it. So these lovely Indiana strawberries that we're going to see in the next 6-8 weeks, they can make jam with them, they can pickle them and enjoy these strawberries in February when you can't get them locally anymore.
Now, where can people find some information about this event?
They can visit the website for the Indiana Historical Society. If you go into the, I believe it's an events tab, they can find that. And also, if you look up Planning to Canning, there's a Facebook event page as well. People can find out information for that, too.
We've been talking with Master Food Preserver Suzanne Krowiak about the Communities Can exhibit at the Indiana Historical Society and the upcoming workshop, Planning to Canning. To register for the free workshop, go to indianahistory.org. We've talked a lot here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio about the changing environment in the hospitality industry, but we've mostly focused on the changing kitchen culture so that there's less harassment and a more professional environment. Well, that extends to the dining public as well, as a recent Facebook post from a local brewery illustrates. An early April post from Blackacre Brewing co-owner Jordan Gleason went viral, and with good reason. In the post, he rails against sexist comments made to one of his employees and the reaction of the customer who was banned from the brewery. The post gained national attention and has been shared more than 38,000 times. The reaction also prompted Blackacre founder and co-owner Holly Miller to convene a discussion for women in the hospitality industry. I stopped in at Blackacre this week to catch up with Jordan and Holly and to see what the reaction has been.
And I just wanted to hear his side, but I also wanted to tell him, our side about how, we expect this place to be a safe place, that the girls here who work for me, the ladies, I should say, they're here to do their job, and they're not here to do anything more than that. Like, so they're here to make a welcoming space, and that kind of comment is not tolerated. And then so I told him, not only that he was wrong, but then why he was wrong. And then
did he offer, any sort of justification for what he said?
He said that we were men and they were women, and that's just how it is. And I was like, no, that's not true. And more importantly, he said he had apologized, but he just wasn't backing down from what I was saying. He's like, no, they shouldn't wear low cut shirts if that's what you're going to do, or they should face the glass washing station away from the customers. And like, I was like, no, clearly your apologies don't mean anything. And I was like, that's not how, like, they're human beings. They deserve respect. And just because you said about the t-shirts and about the dishwashing station just shows me that you don't even understand what I'm trying to tell you. And so, like, your apology does not mean anything to me. And, you know, I explained that he had to leave.
Sure. But it didn't stop there. So tell me what you were thinking next.
So the weird thing is, I talk about this subject with my fiance a lot. She lives in New York City, and she has to deal with this a lot as a woman in the music industry. And, she manages some bands. And so it runs through my head all the time. We've talked about this so many times. And she was actually in L.A. For iHeart Radio Awards. And so, like, normally I probably would have just called her and been like, this is what just happened. I'm very upset about this. I need to let this off my chest because I have to go back to serving people on the floor and talking to people and being nice. And I think Holly could attest to this, that I get kind of passionate and bent up out of shape. So I have to, like, let off some steam before I can be normal again. And so I just was sitting there, and I was, like, getting angrier and angrier and angrier in the back. And I just started, so I started writing, because Carl, my fiance, she goes by Carl. Her last name's Carlson. Sorry, that's an odd bit. Carl always tells me that I should write out my feelings when I get, like, this way. So okay. I just started writing, and mostly just to the women I work with and to the people in my life on, I guess, via Facebook, that, you know, I wanted to tell them that I see this and I see them, and it's like, this hurts me to watch them suffer this way. And so it sort of spilled out of me, and then I would write for, like, a paragraph, then come out to the floor, wash some dishes, run some food, and, like, I was doing this while I was managing. It was, like, all Friday night.
So this was all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm still, like, on the floor, and I'm, like, still processing this as I'm writing, and it was just kind of, like, I don't know. It was really weird. It kind of just kind of flowed right out of me onto the keyboard. And then, I just posted it, and I didn't even think much of it.
Now, when was that? Tell me when that was.
I made the post like 9 o'clock that Friday, and by when I went to sleep, there was like 10, 15 shares, and I was like, oh, that's cool. And then I woke up, and it was at like 200, and I was like, oh, interesting. And then Saturday night, it was like up to 1,000, and I'm like, uh-oh, something's happening. And then everybody started making jokes about how I broke the internet and all that stuff, so.
And now, did you think at the time that you had hit a nerve and that other people, might... you know, have been waiting for somebody to say this?
I didn't think I hit a nerve until Saturday night. And because, like, Steve was one of our other owners, made a joke about me breaking the internet. And I was like, ha ha, right. This will never go that far. And then just that Saturday night kind of exploded. And I started feeling, then that's when I started getting messages.
Now, what kind of messages? Good? Bad?
Yeah. I've not read a single negative message, which is really lovely. But no, it's like thousands and thousands of messages. Holly had to deal with, she handles the inbox for the company, amongst other things. And so she started forwarding them to me, and I just started, like, it was thousands. It's now thousands of messages and hundreds of Facebook friend requests. And you have to be a friend of mine to get there, but still hundreds and hundreds.
Were you surprised?
Yes. Yes. And overwhelmed. Very overwhelmed. I would argue that I'm a pretty duty-bound person, so I wanted to try to respond to all of them, but then it just became this snowball that got too big for me to handle. And
well, now, in case people, haven't been following what you were writing about, kind of go over the gist of your Facebook post.
I started off explaining the story. I know a lot of people wanted to talk about how I said he was a 6-year-old man. I only mentioned that because to show that he was not this, like, young kid who was still figuring it out. As we all know, like, we all make mistakes, especially, like, I've gone through a journey with my masculinity and understanding what being a strong female is. It took me a while to learn that lesson. And I think, but he was not a young person. He was an older person. He should have known better is the point. And then so I kind of explained the story, and then I started writing about the fact that, I love this job, and I think everybody in this industry likes working with people. That's why we're in it. I mean, the money is obviously the second reason, but we're people persons, I guess, and we get off on talking to people and, like, engaging with humanity, and, like, that's huge to us, and it's very important. The problem with that is, there's always bad apples, and we have to deal with that. And you get a thick skin about a lot of that, like, someone's kind of a jerk or doesn't tip you, or, it's just rude, snaps their fingers at you, and, threatens you, and,
those sort of things you overlook, right?
Part of the business. It's still unfortunate, but, right. Yeah, it's part of the business. And then the second thing was, noticing and then saying that, like, this happens way, 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 way worse for the women in this field than it does for the men. And I think a lot of it's because it's a power dynamic thing. You know, because you're being served, you have control of their money. So, like, a lot of times, if something is said that's inappropriate, I think, you know, people, anyone, is they're worried about their tip, so they'll just won't say anything. And some people will abuse that power and just go way too far. And I think then that second part of the post was mostly about, like, saying, women, I see this, and this drives me crazy. It really infuriates me. And it's not fair, and they don't deserve it. And then the next part of the post was sort of, I guess, the call to arms portion, which I was saying to men, like, our silence is complicity in this sort of engagement. I can't tell you the number of times at all how, you know, there'll be one guy in a group of dudes, and he'll be the one sexist jerk who's just running his mouth, and every other dude at the table will say nothing. You can maybe see that they're uncomfortable by this, and they're like, well, I'm not saying this, so I'm not the bad guy. And so they sort of just, like, tune him out. But by tuning him out, they're just... Imagine if you were to walk up to that table, and you're the one person, and there's 15 people there, and one guy is talking at you, and everybody else is silent. You're just going to sort of, like, internalize that, like, they're all on the same team. And, like, so if we as men don't stand up to this, like Edmund Burke, you know, would have said, like, triumph of evil, good men not doing anything. I'm paraphrasing that a lot right now. And so if we as men don't stand up and say, that's wrong, man, stop, then it's just going to keep continuing. And, you know, that's kind of our role in the struggle for feminism should always be, and by feminism, I very, very much mean equality of the sexes. I don't mean anything more than that. To me, that's, you know, men and women being treated equally and fairly. That's what feminism has meant to me for a long time. And I think if we don't do that one part to make, you know, them be treated equally, then we are just as much to blame as the dude who's saying the stuff. And that drives me crazy to watch people just be silent. And so, like, I hope in some small way that has helped. I mean, one of the regulars of mine who's a female, she's a server somewhere else, and she said, you know, she would go home crying some nights because this would happen to her, and her mom wouldn't understand at all why she was upset. And then her dad was the kind that would make those off-color jokes, and I'm saying that very disparagingly with quotes, since you can't see my fingers. And her dad came up to her and apologized. And he's like, I never realized. I thought I was just being funny. I didn't realize that's why you were so upset all the time. Because he read the post, and he was like, he apparently, a very emotional moment for the whole family. And that's really cool that my words could resonate and maybe change some hearts and minds.
We've been talking with Jordan Gleason of Blackacre Brewing about his viral Facebook post about sexism in the hospitality industry. We'll be back with more from co-owner Holly Miller here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Social media can have considerable power. Case in point, a recent Facebook post, a rant really, about sexist comments made to an employee at Blackacre Brewing in Indianapolis went viral. It's been shared more than 38,000 times and has drawn media attention to the harassment that restaurant and bar employees experience every day. Blackacre co-owner Jordan Gleason's post brought attention to the problem of sexual harassment from customers, one that co-owner Holly Miller has faced thousands of times. Holly put together a discussion about the issue recently for women in the hospitality industry, and I talked with her and Jordan about the problem, the reactions, and some possible solutions.
Well, I've actually been into this topic for a really long time. Back in college, I was president of my student group, which was Friends of Middleway House, down at IU in Bloomington. And it was, you know, women's shelter. I headed up a lot of the domestic violence and sexual assault, like education, kind of liaison between campus and Middleway House and all that kind of stuff. So it's really been close to my heart for a long time. I've also been in the service industry since I was 18, so between hostessing and serving and bartending. So I'm a woman brewery owner. And it's a very male-dominated industry, just brewing on its own.
So as part of the industry, you've experienced this very same thing.
Yes, absolutely. My reaction, obviously, it's always I'm happy that it became viral so that we can talk about it. That's the main thing. Like Jordan was saying, I mean, there's a lot of men out there who don't realize, like, they're not bad people. They just don't realize that what they're saying affects us the way it does. And as women, we've always been taught to let it, you know, just let it roll off. Don't worry about it. Just let it roll off your shoulder, get over it, move on. It's time to stop that. No, I don't have to accept that. You know, this is a transaction. Yes, they have money. I want their money. But guess what? They also want my beer and my food. And you're here because you can't make this on your own. So I've got something you want, and you've got something I want. So we are equal partners in this transaction.
Well, no, that's a very good point.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just I'm serving you and you take advantage of it. This is equal here. And it really is all about basic respect. That's all this is.
So tell me about the conversation and what you did the other night to sort of continue the discussion.
We were, you know, sharing some of our own experiences, how we dealt with that, how we wish we would have dealt with it. And, you know, it was really almost more of like a support group. I had a clinical psychologist there as support. I'm also had the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence there. So anyway, we were kind of brainstorming what's next. You know, nothing's officially decided yet, but one of the biggest things that I'm most excited about, besides, you know, putting this campaign together as a discussion, you know, so people will be talking about it, is also, I guess they call it bystander training.
Now, tell me what that is. That's interesting.
Yeah. So what it is, like Jordan was saying, there's so many people who, they don't know how to address it, and they don't know how to say it. And you know, sometimes if you're the server or whatever, you know, in the moment, maybe you don't know how to deal with it. The whole thing is about, if you see it happen, how you address it, you know, whether you're serving or not. And so we were talking about, potentially getting a whole like campaign together of bystander training. And actually, I mean, this can go in any industry. We're just kind of focusing on the service industry right now, but, actually doing in-services at bars and restaurants around the city. So people understand, you know, how you deal with it if it's not happening to you. And, you know, we want to get a lot of, we want people to be able to handle themselves. But at the same time, it's really important for management and owners and stuff to do that too. It's all about, you know, making a culture of a safe space. And, I think the bystander training would help that a lot.
Do you see change coming in the hospitality industry? We've been hearing a lot about how kitchens need to change, and that sort of thing. Are you seeing that happening?
I think so. I mean, it's slow change, but it is all about shifting the culture. It's basically all about respect. And I think we're starting to figure that out, hopefully.
What were some of the reactions of the women who came to the discussion recently?
Oh, man, it was heavy at times. You know, there, when people were sharing their stories, you know, like I said, we're always been taught to just let it roll off your shoulder, but especially what happens is you start internalizing it, and it keeps building and building and building until you do go home and you cry and you don't know how to deal with it. There was someone there who it was happening from a boss. You know, how do you deal with that? She quit her job because she just didn't want to deal with it. It's sad. It's really sad. But everyone at the meeting was, very hopeful, mm-hmm. and very excited, about talking about the topic. There were actually quite a few owners of businesses there also. So, women owners. So, you know, we're all obviously very passionate about that topic. And I think just with the group of people that were there, we really could make some change, at least starting here in Indianapolis.
It sounds like this is the beginning of a movement. Do you kind of envision that?
I sure hope so. like I said, this has been a passion of mine for a long time. And since, you know, starting a business, it's kind of dropped to the wayside a little bit. I'm kind of busy. I'm also a nurse full time too. So, I keep busy. But I am really passionate about this. So I love the idea that I love that this topic is back up again and that I can in some way kind of help lead it.
Was there any thought or reaction to the fact that it was a man's post that prompted the discussion?
Right. We were talking about that. If I had written the post, even though I am an owner, you know, but I'm a woman, and it just probably wouldn't have gotten so far because people may have seen that as a, oh, she's complaining about it again. Okay, get over it. But when a man stands up and says something, all of a sudden it catches everybody's eye like, oh, yeah, I don't think it would have gotten the same reaction from a woman.
That was what my thought was at first was, okay, you know, we say this sort of thing a lot,
yeah,
and it doesn't seem to resonate, you know, so there is a bit of a frustration.
Absolutely.
That it took a man's perspective to make it resonate.
Exactly. You know, but if this is how we had to get the ball rolling on it, I guess that's how it goes.
I think that's part of our responsibility as good allies to the movement, that like we can use our privilege to say stuff that, you know, Holly should be able to say, or, you know, you should be able to say. But, you know, unfortunately, that's not the ball game we're in, and so I'm very angry that it was me and not her, that when my words have power and hers don't. That's not fair. But I will use whatever privilege I have to get the message across. That's all.
And change the ballgame.
Yeah, hopefully.
What do you foresee happening?
I envision this being much larger, actually being able to, like I said, the bystander in-service trainings at bars and restaurants around the city. And I don't know, we're still trying to figure out what that is. But in general, like, you know, some kind of a campaign that really has, you know, education and support groups and things like that.
We've been talking with Holly Miller and Jordan Gleason of Black Acre Brewing in Indianapolis. For more information on the brewery, look for it on Facebook or check out blackacrebrewing.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms, home canning expert and master food preserver Suzanne Krowiak, and Jordan Gleason and Holly Miller of Black Acre Brewing in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, Indy.